Hello, everyone. This is March Twisdale, and I'd like to welcome you to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. You're listening to Voice of Vashon, webcast in real time at voiceofvashon.org, also available on archive and broadcast on Comcast Channel 21. Today, I am talking with another of the wonderful conference faculty members here at the 2013 Port Townsend Writers Conference, Midge Raymond. And we will be discussing Ashland Creek Press, which she and her husband co-founded. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, March, for inviting me.
Yay, this is fun. Okay, so as a quick reminder to our listeners, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is a new program here at Voice of Vashon with the simple goal of offering authors of fiction, memoir, and poetry an opportunity to discuss how they use their art to inspire social change. But today we're going to take that slight detour and talk about various works of inspiring eco-fiction and other genres from the publisher's perspective. To start us off, Midge, could you tell us a little bit about what drew you and your husband to the publishing side of literature, eco-fiction, and sort of how you got involved in all this?
Well, John and I have both worked in publishing. We lived in New York for many years and Boston as well, where we were both involved with publishing companies and a lot of magazine and communication writing. And John has a marketing and design background, and I have a strong editorial background. So co-founding a press is actually, we didn't know it at the time, but as it turns out, it's a dream come true. The reason it first came about was that John had written a book that was an eco-thriller. He decided that was what the genre was. Mm-hmm. He had a wonderful New York agent who tried to sell it during the Great Recession,
right,
which did not go well. Mm-hmm. And John decided that he really wanted to get that book out into the world anyway. Mm-hmm. And that was in part because he was so passionate about the issues in the book, which have to do with many things such as anti-whaling, the fate of penguins and other marine animals, birds,
right,
and animals due to overfishing and climate change and the warming of the oceans.
Oh, and we've got someone wandering up the stairs. I love being here in this old building at Fort Worden.
Yeah, we're in this wonderful schoolhouse in Fort Worden. It's so much ambiance.
I know. I'm like, okay. Oh, and Officer and a Gentleman was filmed
That's
here.
That's right. I know. I first came here and I thought, this is so familiar. Why? And then
yeah,
I realized what
we
it was.
We walk in the footprints of the stars. So back to the book. I actually haven't heard the title of the book yet.
Oh, I'm so sorry. The title is The Tourist Trail.
The Tourist Trail.
And it's named after a place in Argentina, in the Patagonia region of Argentina. The book was inspired when John and I went down there to be part of a penguin census. There's
right.
a fabulous organization at the University of Washington called, it was called the Penguin Project. It might still be mm-hmm. called the Penguin Project, or maybe Penguin Sentinels. But a woman named Dee Boersma mm-hmm. has been studying the penguins, the Magellanic penguins of Punto Tumbo
yeah.
in Argentina.
And that's right on the teeny tip next to Antarctica, yes?
It's very close. Very
right.
close. Not the very tip, mm-hmm. not down all the way down to Ushuaia, but very far down south.
Right, right.
And so they're not Antarctic penguins, but she's been studying this colony for 25 years and has
right.
seen, you know, they study the penguins, they put satellites on the birds, they tag the birds so they can see their rates of reproduction, they can see how far they have to go for food.
Right.
And it was really fascinating to learn all this
right.
and to be down there and to see that penguins have to go farther and farther for food because the
right.
fishing industry mm-hmm. is taking their food and to see how they deal with climate change and all these other things. So
right.
he got very, very passionate about that and wrote this book and just knew he'd have to self-publish it to get out into the world. So he did self-publish it, and that was great. And in the meantime, there's a lot that was going on, but one thing that happened for us is that my book went out of print because my publisher closed.
A lot of publishers.
And that was
heard
one of
story a
several.
Lot.
So we began thinking, so my book Forgetting English went out of print. I ended up finding a new publisher for that, but it got us thinking because we knew there were a lot of other writers and poets mm. with orphaned books.
Right.
So we started thinking, they need a home. You know, they need an opportunity to get their work out into the world because we knew some of these writers and they're amazing mm. writers. And if you don't have the background in publishing, what are you going to do with your book, you know,
mm-hmm.
once it's out of print? It's almost like that's a dead end. So we decided to found a press, which
right.
is, everyone looks at us like we're a little crazy when
right.
we say that. And it is crazy. But if you don't think about it too much, you can do crazy things.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So we did it. We put John's book under the imprint, and we started. We just put out an awning and said, "Hey, you know, if you have, we our little tagline is books with a worldview.
Right.
Books that connect us all, whether it's environment or multicultural issues. You know, anything that makes us all understand one another a little better.
Right.
As inhabitants of this shared planet."
And understand the planet and see more clearly. That's beautiful. I am so excited to have met you at this conference.
Me
too. Thrilled. Because, I mean, it's, you know, the world of writing, publishing is just this huge world, and it's just so fun to encounter it. So a question that came to mind, because we went for a lovely walk and talked about this interview a bit, and then it's been percolating around in my head. And one of the questions that came up was that authors have different ways of approaching their work, their goals, their readers, and you have worked hand in hand with them from a publisher's perspective, not just a fellow writer. Can you share with us maybe some of the motivations? Like, we know now what drove your husband's work. I'm just wondering what other types of motivations. The reason I'm asking this is when I was talking with Terrence Hayes 2 days ago, he was talking about, yeah, it's great to write stuff down and get it out there in written form, but that we can't ignore life and focus just on this written part of life. We need to be physically active in the world and take involved action. So his wife and daughters, while he's been here, they've been involved in some marches, I think, on the, you know, on their Capitol about what happened with the Trayvon Martin case. And, you know, he's been involved. He's seen some Occupy activities. And so it's like we talk about the inciting incident in a book, which is usually that moment where things just explode and everything falls after it. And it seems that there needs to be an inciting incident in the life, the real concrete life of the author, which then leads to them starting to think, I want to write this down and flesh this out. And so what are some of the inciting incidents maybe that your authors have experienced in their real physical lives that have led to their books?
That's a great question. And I wish I had all my authors sitting here with us, because it's hard to speak for them. But I do know in talking with them and talking about their work and going through the whole editorial process that it's different for everyone. So they all have different passions and they all come from different places. And the one thing I think is important in this genre, if you want to call it eco-literature, is to make sure the story comes first. And I think that that's something interesting that happens in the process of a writer, that you don't start necessarily, you may have an issue in mind, something you want to get off your chest, but you also have to absorb it into a story so that it's successful as a piece of literature, as a novel or a short story or whatever. And one example I can think of is we published a novel called Balance of Fragile Things by a woman, an author named Olivia Chada. She's a wonderful author. And she, I know this was partly inspired by having lived in upstate New York and having gotten sick because of ground contamination of the groundwater.
Oh.
And so she experienced this, and it made her think a lot about environmental pollution and, you know, the big companies that dump their stuff in the ground and all the chemicals that are lurking and affecting us in the air, the water supply. So that was a huge thread going through her book, even though it is a book about a multi-generational Indian-Latvian family. You know, so it had a lot going on for it, and the environmental theme was woven in.
Right.
But it sticks out to readers, I hope, and it makes them think, I hope. Mm-hmm. And I think she did a really successful job with that. I know with another book, the author Mindy Mejia, who wrote a novel called The Dragon Keeper, which we are so delighted to publish. Mm-hmm. Such a wonderful book. She got interested in it because she saw an interview on, I think it was Jon Stewart, with a woman who was a Komodo dragon keeper at a zoo.
Right.
And she loved this character and the idea of a woman, you know, taking care of dragons. So she started to research Komodo dragons and learned all these interesting things
they
about them.
They are so fascinating.
They're fascinating.
And we still don't fully understand them, I don't think. Like, have they figured out exactly why the bite kills?
I think it might be a venom.
Okay, that's...
Again, I wish Mindy were here. She would know. She knows everything.
The last time there was there was maybe a bacteria or something. But I love it that even
maybe not a venom. I'm thinking of the saliva. I think that's, that might be the saliva that kills.
It's just beautiful when even today we don't have an answer.
Well, and that's the tragedy about the Komodo dragon, because they were discovered, I think it was about 100 years ago, give or take, and they're already endangered. They were endangered so soon after being discovered, which is one of the things that's kind of amazing about what we need to think about when it comes to preserving these species, because once they're gone, they're gone.
And how quickly that changed.
And how quickly that
loss
can happen.
Could occur.
Yeah. So she did wonderful research and got very involved with it, and that's another thing that's great about being a writer, and is, mm-hmm. That you have an idea and you think about something on a level where you're just curious about it, right? And mm-hmm. then you start to get into it, and then she created this beautiful novel that brings into question a lot of issues about zoos and conservation and, mm-hmm. The fact that animals are kept in captivity, which is not a good thing for the animals. At the same time, zoos do a great deal of conservation, and mm-hmm. they're a sanctuary for many animals that otherwise mm-hmm. wouldn't, would be in a lot of trouble. So she has a wonderful balance there that I think is great, because it doesn't tell readers how to think, but it gets them thinking.
Exactly. My husband always says that I don't want to tell my children what to think. I just want to teach them how to think for themselves.
Beautiful. Absolutely true.
When I was talking with Patricia just earlier today, it was interesting that she mentioned her book, Hummingbird House, and she spent 10 years in travel, and she said, of all of the projects I've worked on, that one seemed to be like just more, she was more passionate about it, or it had a different energy in a way. And I find, she's this woman that you're talking about. What's her name again?
Mindy.
So she's watching a Jon Stewart show.
Yeah.
And she stumbles across something, and yet there was something about that that made it click and made it stick. And I hear that over and over from authors. What made you think of that? Well, I've had all these other ideas, and then this one just stuck with me.
Yeah,
exactly. It's very interesting how that happens.
It is.
So, You already alluded to this earlier. One piece of sage advice, and readers, you can rest assured that, trust me, this is often a repeated piece of advice to fiction writers, is to don't lecture the reader. No one really wants to be lectured. In fact, Jack Bickham, who unfortunately has already passed away but has a lovely book, he says, don't lecture the reader to the author. Says, don't lecture the reader. And then he says, and you, character, don't you lecture the reader either. So it's very good advice. And I think you were alluding to that when you mentioned that, this is not nonfiction. We're not trying to tell people how they should do things differently and how they should act and basically make a legal case for a new behavior. We're trying to create a story that we will fall into the shoes of our characters. We will forget that we're sitting in our office or on the bus or in our bedroom, and we are now in Tahiti or in Antarctica, and that we will be brought along this world, this experience, cry with them, hope with them. And at the end, because of the emotion, because of the entry to our heart and being in their shoes, we come out of that changed. Not as changed as if we had actually gone, like you and your husband did, down and saw the penguins, but because of the power of fiction, it's just so, it can be more altering to our future life once we close that last page. So I am wondering, for those who are listening, many of whom may already be writing or considering writing about something that they care deeply about, what's some advice you give to your authors about how to avoid sounding preachy without giving up on their message, about how to find that balance?
That it's such a great question. I'm really glad you asked that question. It's so important. And John and I have done workshops on this, because it's so wonderful to have writers who have passion for the environment and for getting these stories out into the world. But there's so many possibilities for leaning toward being a little preachy, or being too didactic. So I have a couple of tips, definitely. And one of them is to be sure to create conflict among the characters. So for example, if you have a vegan character, as one example, well, I can give you two examples. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking books with vegan characters. And, vegan, it's a very environmental way to live. It's an animal friendly way to live. Not everyone, vegans are in the minority still, mm-hmm. obviously. But so we have two books with vegan characters. One is an eco mystery called Falling into Green, where the protagonist, who becomes a detective, she's an eco psychologist who gets pulled into a mystery, mm-hmm. and plays detective. And it's a wonderful, wonderful book. So she's a vegan character.
Falling into Green.
Falling into Green.
Great title.
Fun title, yeah. So she, She's a vegan character, and I think for some readers, she may come across as preachy. That happens, because not everyone is on board. Not everyone is as green as this character, because she is unapologetically green. She drives a hybrid car. She recycles everything. Everything she buys is chemical-free and recycled, yada, yada, yada. She's great. And so she... The great thing about this book is that she is falling for a meat-eating, Hummer-driving TV news reporter.
I love it!
Yeah, everything she's against, basically, and yet she loves this guy. So so that's one good way to create conflict. And the same in our young adult series. We have a young adult trilogy. It's called the Lithia Trilogy. And in that book, what the author is doing is she has a great female, young female protagonist who's a vegan and animal rights person, and she falls in love with someone who's also a carnivore. And so this conflict is great, and it's important to show both sides, because no one is perfect. And, you know, everyone has their journey, and everyone has different things they can do for the planet. For some, it may be eating vegan. For others, it may be planting trees. For others, it may be not using plastic. You know, everyone has something to contribute, and I think they need to find what that is and not get too anxious. Because you wouldn't get out of bed if you really thought about it too much. We do take up space on this planet.
Right.
We're here. We just have to do our very, very best.
Yeah.
You know, in whatever way we can. Mm-hmm. So conflict between characters, I think, is really important. Showing all sides of an issue is really important. Because then, if you're not focusing on only one side of the story, it has a necessary balance for readers to focus on the conflict, the characters, the story, the plot, enjoy and get immersed without thinking they're being preached to. So we look for books that put story and character before whatever issues there might be. We like to see things that are woven in. Well-written, beautiful stories that have these themes are wonderful, exactly what we're looking for. But most of all, it's about a good story. That's the most important thing for what we look for.
Right, absolutely. And you do only fiction, or do you also do poetry?
We do only fiction.
Okay.
And we have a couple of nonfiction books, but we really want to focus primarily on fiction.
Has it sort of like, I mean, this is a joke. Does it sort of like save the marriage to only focus on fiction and not try and spread it out too far? I mean, I can imagine it could get really overwhelming if you were trying to cover everything.
Oh, yeah, we can't cover everything.
Right.
Yeah,
right,
and
right.
We would love to publish poetry. And one day, you know, maybe we'll expand and have a poetry editor. But we are not qualified to publish poetry. But
and you're a little bit too smart to maybe push yourself too far too quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds like. And when did you first start the press?
We started it in 2011.
Oh, so it's fairly new.
Yes,
I had
it's
the impression
new.
Maybe it was like mid, you know, like 2005, right? Had a sense.
Thank you. We do have quite a few books. We have about a dozen books or so. And so we really went out of the gate with with a bang. We've published a lot. So we're slowing down a little bit. And, you know, we're working on just taking it slow and sticking with our niche and maybe honing our niche a little bit.
Right.
You know, as an environmental press.
You earlier... we went on the walk, the term eco-fiction had come up. Eco-thriller is your husband's work. Mm-hmm. But there was another word that you used just a few minutes ago in the interview.
Eco-mystery?
No. Eco-literature? I think, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, because the term eco, unfortunately, you know, you can have some backlash to that from certain groups. Do you ever, when in the actual books... sometimes there's that section where it'll talk about what genre the book is. Are you guys unabashedly eco-literature, eco-fiction, or do you ever have authors who are like, I want to publish this, but I want to not highlight that aspect because it's another way of trying to sneak it in the back door and make it about story and not about message so much. Do you ever have anyone who wants to avoid the genre name?
Actually, not really, because most people find us because of the niche that we have.
Right.
And the other thing about our authors are wonderful, and they understand that you have to go for a broad range of readers to get your book out into the world, and it happens slowly, and word of mouth sometimes happens slowly. Mm-hmm. And certain books appeal to different audiences. So Olivia's book, for example, will appear to the Indian community, the Latvian community, anyone who's interested in multicultural literature.
And groundwater.
And, yes,
and
environmental
issues. A lot more
issues.
People nowadays, I mean, with the fracking going on, so like the American people are waking up and going, wait a minute, what's happening here?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So important on many levels. It has appeal on many different levels. And our authors have been wonderful about tapping into those different audiences. Mm-hmm. And we do that with the marketing that we do as well. We try to send books, depending on what they're about, sending them to publications that will be interested in these issues, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, Publishers Weekly and Library Journal and the trades, right. you know, but we send them to specific targeted audiences
right.
also who might be interested because, you know, an animal rights organization might be interested to read a book with a vegan character and review it
offer
on their,
in their catalog.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So. Do you, do you do any international work yet? Are you only in the United States? Or?
Well, our books are print on demand. So,
okay.
That's another thing that we do partly for environmental reasons and mm-hmm. also for financial reasons. It's very expensive to print, ship, you know, warehouse books. Mm-hmm. So print on demand allows us to do what we do mm-hmm. without a lot of overhead. Also, there's so much waste in publishing that it's an environmentally mm-hmm. friendly choice. Usually in publishing, publishers will do a print run and they have to warehouse them. They have to store them. Eventually, they might pulp them.
Mm-hmm.
We also don't take returns as a rule. I mean, we're very flexible when working with bookstores and organizations. Mm-hmm. But as a general rule, we haven't gone that route, which is traditional. Mm-hmm. Because what tends to happen, and we've done a lot of research and
Let me jump in and clarify that for our listeners that may not understand it. And correct me if I'm saying it wrong, but So Artist Trust is a wonderful organization in Washington, and they have a professional development program for literary artists. And that's where I picked up this information this spring when I was accepted into the program. And I learned that apparently within the publishing industry, it's completely normal that when you send books to, in particular, a box store like Costco or, you know, Barnes & Noble or whatnot, that at any point that store can return every single book they want to return. There's no limit on it, and that the publisher has to accept it back. So it's like, you know, you walk into a Barnes & Noble, there's a table with, you know, just so many of a certain book, and you're just assuming, wow, they're expecting all of those to sell. Well, it makes it look great, but they may send 90% or 70% of them back to the publishers. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is with print on demand, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that people can more carefully say, you know, I want exactly this number, I want these or those, mm-hmm. and it's not the send it this way, send it back, and then what do you have? Basically something to pulp, I think was the word you used.
Yes, exactly.
So that's the environmental impact that's going on with the current normal way of doing things.
I feel that it can be very wasteful because, right. exactly as you said, a bookstore will order for an event, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We've had bookstores call if an author is doing an event and they say, we want like 50 books, let's say. And then we say, well, absolutely, we'll get these books to you. We don't take returns. Do you think you'll be able to sell them out? Just to let you know that you'll have to sell them because we won't accept them back.
Right.
And then they say, whoa. It's very obvious that they like to create displays. They mm-hmm. like to have as many as they can, but also be free to send them back. So right. sometimes they'll cut the order in half. Other times they will sell them out. It just depends on the bookstore. And we've had great success with fabulous indie bookstores
yeah.
where they order books and they support their local author to the extent that they know they'll sell out.
Mm-hmm.
And the authors support their bookstores to the extent that they say, my book is available here. Don't go to Amazon, go here.
Right.
You know, and so that it's a wonderful symbiotic thing. But it's a touchy issue sometimes because bookstores have very narrow margins. We totally get it. We're a small press with a similarly narrow margin.
Right.
So it's a give and take. So the authors usually have plenty of copies. They can bring them as backup. They'll be in the trunk of the car.
Right.
If the bookstore sells out, they'll still have books. And
right.
the bookstore can order about what they think they can sell, which I think is how it should be anyway, but it never is. It's always like 10 times what they think they can sell sometimes.
And if you've got a traveling author, like someone who's, you know, on the road, mm-hmm. they can't bring a lot of copies with mm-hmm. them. What struck me is it's not just about a bunch of books that maybe get returned, don't get sold, and get pulped, but just think about all the shipping.
Yes.
The gasoline, the labor, the time, you know, we're going to ship all these things. It's sort of like what they want to do with coal right now. We're going to pull them out of the middle of the country, ship it through Bellingham, toss it over in China. They'll burn it. It'll come back as acid rain. I mean, I'm like, wow.
It is. There's a huge carbon footprint when you think about sending books to a bookstore and then they don't sell them and then they send them back. And the other thing is they arrive usually in conditions that, from what I hear, I've talked mm-hmm. to a lot of other small press owners about it, you know, they have to destroy so many books. They're unusable, unsellable because they come back in poor condition, having been shipped all over the place.
Right.
So it's not only bad for the environment, but then, you know, you've killed all these trees to create these books, which are then mm-hmm. useless to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
in a way, It might even actually drive down the profit margin for the publisher and the author themselves, because now you've added this big cost element of shipping and waste. Yeah,
absolutely.
So you guys have sidestepped that.
We do. We have several distributors. Ingram, bookstores can buy our books directly through Ingram, which is the biggest distributor. Libraries can go there. Follett and Brodart are very big customers of libraries when they order books. So we are available anywhere, you know, and then we have digital books as well. So it's impossible not to get a copy of the book. And I think your original question was international. And so our books are available digitally, internationally. And thanks to Amazon having shipping, having being so worldwide. And I know people have very different thoughts on Amazon, but as a publisher and as an author as well, I just think it's great to have so many different ways to get one's book out into the world. And because there are people who just have no access to bookstores, and Amazon is just a lifeline for them.
Absolutely.
There are people with no access to libraries, and so who are readers. And so I think it plays an important role. And one of the ways it helps us is that our books, wherever Amazon sells books, we can sell our books.
Right.
So we do have, you could buy, especially digital, copy of our book in many, many countries.
That's
because
awesome.
Of that. And we actually do have forthcoming in the spring a book that is an English translation of a French novel.
Ooh.
And it's a romantic comedy called The Green and the Red, and it's about a vegetarian woman who runs a small restaurant in a small town in France, and about a man who's an executive at a pork producing company who wants that space for a museum and wants to drive her out of it. So he goes to sort of see what she's all about, ends up sort of falling in love with her. Mm-hmm. So they have this whole conflict.
The Green and the Red.
Yes, and we're publishing it first in English because we received the submission as an English translation because France is not ready for that book. They are not ready for vegetarianism.
Oh, I could see
that. Yeah, there's such a food, like a meat-centric food culture over there.
Yeah, and it's such a food culture.
Yeah.
And then, exactly. The French and their food.
I know.
Good luck.
I know. I know. We're hoping there's a good audience for it here and that maybe, and there are, the translator, a woman named Elizabeth Lyman, and she said there's a World Vegan Day in France. So there are vegans in France, and she has a wonderful community there. But as a whole, it hasn't caught on to the extent that Armand Chavel, the writer, the author of the book, couldn't find a French publisher.
Right.
So we're actually hoping that he does, that this might help him. Readers might embrace it, and he can find a publisher.
Right. Well, and it's like a Memoirs of a Geisha, I believe. A lot of people who are not involved in the writing world will have a sense that a book comes out and it's either going to do well or it isn't. And I believe Memoirs is one of those examples of a book that sort of, it floated around. I think it was 2 years after its original publication that somehow enough people read it and told their friends about it, who read it and told their friends about it, who read it and blah, 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 blah. And then it just went kaboom. A movie was made out of it. So this French author may find that he can get this book and start seeding it through his community, and it may become a little sleeper.
Yeah.
That suddenly goes kaboom.
We hope
in a couple years.
Yeah, and that's the nice thing about being a small press is that we take the long view on all of our books, which big publishers usually don't. They've got so much going on.
The 6-week view.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, and we realize that sometimes it takes a long time for a book to take off. And I actually was speaking with a friend of mine who's a writer. She's been publishing since the 70s, publishing both novels and nonfiction. And I said, what do you think over all these years you've been publishing is the best way, is the most important thing in terms of selling your book, like what works in terms of marketing, advertising, all this stuff? She said word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's changed. How that gets out changes. It used to be book reviews. Now it's maybe Facebook, the way word of mouth, and book clubs are big still now. And so the way word of mouth happens is very different, but that basically is what sells books, she said. And I think she's absolutely right.
So as a quick reminder to our listeners, you're tuning in to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose on Voice of Vashon at voiceofvashon.org. My name is Marge Swisdale, and I'm talking today with author and publisher Midge Raymond. So for all of our listeners, but maybe specifically for the young people who, when I was young, I was moving into a world that was intense. I didn't know it was intense, except for a few books about nuclear holocaust, other than that, television turned off at 10 o'clock at night, And I didn't read the newspaper. My parents didn't really talk to me much. And so I had no idea about a lot that was going on. Right now, raising a 14-year-old and an 11-year-old, these kids are absolutely just blisteringly aware of what's going on in the world. And it's intense. So I was wondering what hopes you might like to share with them. For example, how has your work in the field of ecofiction impacted your worldview? Not in the, oh, it's so horrible type of impact, mm-hmm. but, you know, it's still worth it to stay engaged and to stay hopeful, and there's still opportunity for improvement. That, is there anything around that that you want to share with our readers or listeners?
Absolutely, and especially for the young people out there. What I've learned most from this process of publishing eco-literature is that there is hope, that there are amazing creative people doing incredible work that they hope will inspire change, that will entertain first, make people think second, and inspire change third, which I think is so positive. And the reason we like to focus on fiction is that there's really a great deal of wonderful nonfiction out there about these issues. And I think a lot of people get so, as you were saying, sort of oversaturated. They're blisteringly tuned into this stuff. And it is intense, and it might be too much. Whereas if you could tell a good story and have these things woven in, it's a little breath of fresh air, I think, mm-hmm. for people who want to be aware and want to help and want to be positive, but maybe don't want to read about it in a way where there's a specific call to action, or you just get all this data that's horribly depressing. And I think both writers as well as artists have so much to say, and their mm-hmm. passions come through so well in a totally different way. One thing that was really special to us was that one of our books, it's a novel called Float by mm-hmm. Joanne Hart. We were talking about cover art with Joanne and invited her to share her thoughts and any artists that she admires. You know, just let's start brainstorming here about your cover. And she sent us to a website, of the website of a local artist that she knows. She lives in Gloucester, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. named Karen Ristabin. And this woman does sort of beach art, and she has gorgeous, gorgeous photographs that involve, you know, sea glass and the ocean and the water. And she also takes pictures of plastic, you know, and that's a big theme in Joanne's book, Plastics in the Ocean. Right. But we found some images, and John designed the book cover. We found some gorgeous, gorgeous images that just fit perfectly with the title, again, which is Float. Mm-hmm. And the two of them have done events together, mm-hmm. and they go and they talk about... So Karen's art is really all about environmental advocacy, mm-hmm. and Joanne's novel really has that theme underlying, you know, mm-hmm. her book. So, and it's just been wonderful that they could do events together and talk about all of that, and right. they can see Karen's work and hear a bit of Joanne's book. So that's been really great. Mm-hmm. There's just been a lot. And the one thing I have to mention about Mindy's book that I love is that people are so moved by that story mm-hmm. of a dragon. It's like any story that involves an animal and a human being. Like, those touch us so right. much. And usually
you said, like, almost everybody falls at the
everybody
end of the
cries
story.
At the end. Yeah, yeah, reviewers yeah. have said
which,
that.
Which is not a discouragement to no. reading the book.
It's beautiful. Yeah, it's in a good
buy
way.
Buy a Kleenex at the same
it's
time
a good
you buy
cry.
The book.
Yeah. Yeah, even our proofreader. I mean, everyone. It's amazing. But I think that is a testament to the book being able to touch people on that level. Mm-hmm. And I also love that it's not about, you know, a pet cat or a pet dog, but it's about a Komodo dragon, which
right.
is like the least cuddly animal on the planet.
Right.
But she shows well how smart they are and how sensitive
right.
they are.
And I
we need
wait
to keep
to
that
read
in
the
mind
book.
About all reptiles.
I am excited. Now, is this one of the young adult novels?
No, this is a novel for grown-ups.
Okay. Yeah. Because I'm thinking about my youngest son who really likes reading. I'm like, I can't. And he loves animals. But is it a cry? I don't know, you know.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that Al Gore says in An Inconvenient Truth that people will make this leap. They're in denial, they receive information, and they land in despair. Mm-hmm. And along the way, action doesn't happen. Change doesn't happen. You know, they just go kerplunk, kerplunk.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems that what's nice about fiction is fictional characters need to take action, be involved, be empowered, drive the story in most cases. And we end up rooting for them, cheering for them, and in most cases, they achieve their goal. The more outstanding and difficult the obstacle that they overcome, the more exciting the story half the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so when fiction can carry you in the shoes of someone who does something amazing like that, I think that you walk away from that. For me as a teenager, as a preteen, I would walk away from books by like Anne McCaffrey, and I would be sitting in my mundane public school life, and I would think, you know, if mentally could overcome that, then I can overcome this. And if she could keep pursuing her goals, then I can keep pursuing mine. Exactly. And I just think when it comes to hope, hope to me means that you actually think you have a chance to affect change.
Absolutely.
And therefore you have hope.
Absolutely.
And it sounds like your stories that you guys, these authors who you're supporting, are presenting like, you know, the meat guy who falls in love with the vegetarian
yeah.
cook. I mean, you know, you're presenting hopeful stories that are role models in a way for how we might be able to live our lives a little better.
Exactly, exactly. And it's just, I think all of our books in some way show how people evolve, you know, and how mm-hmm. we have to continue to evolve in order to take good care of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all have to, and it's not about making sacrifices. It's just about thinking about things and doing what we can that feels comfortable and feels right. And eventually more and more things will feel right. I don't feel right mm-hmm. putting a glass bottle in a trash can
mm-hmm.
anymore. Simple things like that. But people, I'll carry it around for days if I have
yeah.
to, and I recycle that thing, you know, and the same thing for people, you know, who don't eat meat. I don't eat meat. And that's one, another thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
and there's so many little things people can do to be
yeah.
green, you know, so many, many, many things. And there's a lot of nonfiction that covers that. But what's great about fiction is that we see these characters, these flawed human beings who are
mm-hmm.
just like us.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see, as you were saying, we see what they do and what they're capable of.
Right.
And we're inspired by that.
Yeah. Mitch, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you so much for inviting me. And thank you for all that you're doing with this wonderful program.
Yeah, yeah. No, this is just, it's been wonderful. I'm just so excited. All the authors that I've spoken to are excited. So, Mitch Raymond, author and co-owner of Ashland Creek Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is March Twisdale, and I'd like to thank you for listening to the second installment of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. If you caught us partway through, you've been listening to my interview with Midge Raymond, author and co-owner of Ashland Creek Press. Check out her website, ashlandcreekpress.com, to learn more about eco-fiction and books with a world view. What might you find there? Well, here are a few of their books that I've added to my reading list. First, I'm intrigued by the novel The Green and the Red, mentioned earlier in the interview and described on their website in this way. Meet Leah. She's the idealistic owner and chef of La Dame Verde. Wow, I can't pronounce that at all. Anyways, a vegetarian restaurant struggling in a small French town in Brittany. Meet Matthew. He's the carnivorous marketing director of the town's biggest pork producer, which is trying to put Leah out of business to take over the restaurant's prime real estate. What will happen next, and how will these two characters change each other's lives? Next on my list is Among Animals. The relationship among human and non-human animals go back to the beginning of time, and the ways in which these relationships have evolved and sometimes not is the inspiration for this collection of contemporary short fiction penned by writers from across the globe. This diverse collection of stories explores the ways in which we live among and often in conflict with our non-human counterparts. These stories feature animals from the familiar, dogs and cats, to the exotic, elands and emus. And in these stories, animals are both the rescuers and the rescued. This one I'm pretty sure will be a tearjerker, so I'll make sure to have tissues on hand. And finally, I'm very intrigued by Joanne Hart's novel, Float. When Duncan Leland looks down at the garbage-strewn beach beneath his office window, he sees the words, God help us, scrawled in the sand. While it seems a fitting message, not only is Duncan's business underwater, but his marriage is drowning as well, he goes down to the beach to erase it. Once there, he helps a seagull being strangled by a plastic six-pack holder, the only creature in worse shape than he is at the moment. Now, before you think you can guess where Joanne Hart is going with this, Ashland Creek Press's description goes a bit further. A wry tale of financial desperation, conceptual art, insanity, infertility, seagulls, marital crisis, jellyfish, organized crime, and the plight of a plastic-filled ocean. Joanne Hart's novel takes a smart, satirical look at family, the environment, and life in a hardscrabble seaside town in Maine. Yes, this book is definitely on my reading list. And of course, the list goes on. The Dragon Keeper, Out of Breath, The Ghost Runner, The Tourist Trail, and more. But for now, our time is up. You've been listening to Voice of Vashon webcast at voiceofvashon.org and Comcast Channel 21. Have a local author you'd like me to interview? Email me at marchpower@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. And now we'll end once again with our island's own Cami Lundin and her breakout title song, Run Free.
Like the wild horse runs in the mountains, like the sun sets beyond the sea, like the wind blows through the trees on a crisp autumn evening, wild and free. It can't be caught, it can't be tamed, it cannot be held still. It can't be touched, it can't be felt, it can't be stolen away. And be who you were made to be. Run wild and find the beauty that hides inside, that hides inside. Like the moon floats in the clouds above, like the bird soars in the endless sky, like the thunder that rolls out of sight on a stormy night. Why?